Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Aparuta te sanghamatasa dwara yeso tavanto pamacchantu sadhanam. So for this evening, I'd like to talk about how we talk about meditation. It's a talk about talking about meditation, if that makes sense. And the reason for wanting to do this is because when we're learning meditation and practicing, while obviously our own inner experience and inner wisdom is the primary guide, but it's also essential that we have some input and reflection externally. And so the Buddha said that the two factors giving rise to right view is internal reflection, yonisa manasikara, and also the external voice of another, parato gahusa. And so we meditate ultimately because we've heard the word meditation. If we'd never heard that word or any equivalent word, if no one had described to us what meditation was, if no one had praised meditation, if no one had shown us the benefits of it, if no one had told us how to do it, then none of us would meditate. This is very, very obvious. We can see, for example, in Western culture, a generation ago, or at most two or three generations ago, there was hardly anybody meditated. And that's because there was no words talking about meditation. Now there's countless books on it, countless talks and so on. And so meditation gets into the culture, into the language. And because of that, we have the chance to learn, to look. The words are pointing to something. They're directing us in a certain way. And because these words direct us in a certain way, we go off and meditate. Because we think it sounds reasonable, it sounds attractive, it sounds useful. And in the, if you remember the old Zen saying that about the finger pointing at the moon, yeah, that the words of the teaching is like the finger, it's not the moon. But unfortunately the reality is that most of us wouldn't know. We're so clouded with ignorance that we wouldn't even know where the moon is if we didn't have a finger to point to it. It's only very exceptional individuals who are able to discover the way of meditation by themselves. Of course, the Buddha didn't invent meditation. He adopted and developed practices that he found around him and introduced new ones. But one of the great innovations, which I believe should be ascribed to the Buddha himself, was the ability to describe meditation in a very articulate and careful way. If we look at the pre-Buddhist texts, we see a lot of texts that sort of use words and language that sound meditative, sounds like a contemplative and reflective text, and yet it's hard to find a, or impossible to find, like a really clear or explicit description of what exactly they were doing. We find plenty of those things in the later Hindu or Brahmanical texts and things like the Yoga Sutra and other texts. We find lots of very clear descriptions of meditation, and they of course use the same meditation vocabulary or an adapted version of it, which it seems that they learned from the Buddhist community. So the idea of actually describing meditation very clearly and very specifically was something that the Buddha introduced. So this has a number of important implications. If we look at the pre-Buddhist discussions or meditative kind of texts and passages, you see is these kind of very vague, some mystical passages. I am that. You. I have become one, or something like that. You hear these kind of mystical, cosmic sayings, which are very nice. They're very evocative. They're quite inspiring. But they don't really tell you what's going on. And the problem with that kind of language is that two people can use exactly the same language and yet be meaning completely different things by it. And one person can talk about a feeling of oneness with everything. And by that they mean that they're actually completely separate from everything, and there's a sense of themselves here and a sense of everything else out there, but that there's an understanding in their mind that they understand the connection between their self and here and the world out there. That's one way that people might say, I feel at one with everything. Another person might say, I feel at one with everything, and that's because their consciousness has expanded and become infinite, so that the experience of themselves is no different from the experience of everything else. And that's a very profound state of meditation. One state is a state of just reflection, a reflective understanding, and the second state is a state of highly purified and transcendent consciousness. They're completely different kinds of things, and yet we can describe them using the same words. So of course this is the problem when we are trying to teach meditation, trying to communicate, trying to lead people along a path. So when the Buddha talked about meditation, he adopted the language that was in the culture at the time, but he used it in his own very specific way. One of the problems is that our use of language is always different from the Buddha's, because we're primarily conditioned by the way that the Buddha used the language, whereas the Buddha was primarily conditioned by the way that his surrounding culture used it. And you see that difference in perspective. He was coming from that cultural background and using the words in a specific way. We can't see that cultural background, but we can only get a glimpse at it, and we just take up the specific way that the Buddha used it. So we have a very different perspective on these things. So for example, we take the word jhana. Now in the Buddhist community these days, the word jhana has become very common. It's a normal word, and it is and it should be a part of the sort of anglicized vocabulary of Buddhism. So we can use, for example, we can say jhanas. So the word jhanas is a English word. And there's no form in any Indic language which corresponds with the word jhanas. So it's become anglicized to that extent that we can use it with English grammar in an English sentence. Now when we use the word jhana, of course, we're always pointing back to the four jhanas which are described so often in the Buddhist texts, being virtually the only way that the word jhana is used. There's a few others, but basically that's how jhana is always used in the early texts. Now when the Buddha used the word jhana, he was coming from quite a different place. If we look in the kind of the pre-Buddhist usage of the word jhana, the oldest use of it is the word dhi, which is the old Vedic form. And the word dhi meant the inspired consciousness of the Vedic poets, the kind of illumined, rapturous consciousness, where the Vedic poets would spontaneously utter the verses. So you can see that there's a kind of connection there with the Buddhist use of the word jhana, but it's not exactly the same. And of course, in the later Brahmanical culture between the Vedas and the Buddha, there were various other ways that the word jhana became used. So the Buddha, coming from that background, then adopted this particular term and used it in quite a narrow and defined sense, and defined it in terms of the well-known formula of the four jhanas. So I hope you can see what I'm getting at when I'm pointing to these two different ways of using language, and the Buddha using a general non-technical word which is available in the culture in a number of senses, and then using that in one very specific sense. But then for us, we're only really aware of that one specific sense, and we're not aware of all the diversity of it, the term available in the culture. So inevitably, this leads to a number of different problems. Now, when the Buddha talked about jhanas, you know, what's most outstanding about it is that he didn't talk about these kinds of ideas of becoming one with Brahman or anything like this, but he described it in very straightforward, empirical, psychological terms. He said there are these certain mental factors which are present in the first jhana, vitaka, vichara, piti, sukha, ekagata, initial and sustained application, rapture, happiness, and unification of mind. And there's certain other things that are absent, particularly the five senses are absent and the five hindrances are absent. So none of these are anything mystical or metaphysical. There's nothing particularly even uniquely spiritual or religious about these things, in a sense. They're just ordinary mental factors which we can discern to a greater or lesser extent in everyday consciousness, and what's present in jhana is a purified and perfected form of these. In other words, what the Buddha was doing was he was trying to describe that state of consciousness using ordinary language, using words that people around him could understand. Yes, using them in a refined way, because we're talking about a refined state of consciousness. Of course, the exact meaning of these words is different in jhana than it is outside of jhana. Obviously, we're talking about an altered state of consciousness, adhicitta, a higher mind. But still, we can understand by analogy that there's similar mental processes going on. And so this, the reason why these are taught so often and taught in this way, is because it then allows us to check, allows us to understand our own mind. Are these factors present? Are the factors absent? What is this state of mind like? And so when we understand it, we can then adjust our practice, move on. We can correct ourselves if our mind is not moving in that direction, or if it doesn't have those qualities. Yeah? Then we can understand that, and we can introduce the right kind of remedies and correct our meditation. So it's essentially a pragmatic description of consciousness. The state, of course, in the state of jhana, one could list a whole bunch of other mental factors which are also present, as well as those five jhana factors. And indeed, that is done in some places, such as the Anapada Sutta, and the Abhidhamma does it in more detail later on. But the point is that these particular factors are the most important, and the ones that we really have to look at to develop them. It's a pragmatic definition. Or description, better not a definition, a description. So that description of jhanas is there to help us practice, that's all. Not for any other reason. Now, the problem then comes in later times and in contemporary usage when rather than using that term jhana to help us describe the actual experience and to help us advance in our practice, it gets used, I think, in almost exactly the opposite way. And often when we hear people talking about jhanas, it doesn't actually describe that state of consciousness at all. On the contrary, it hides the state of consciousness. It doesn't help people to practice. On the contrary, it stops people from practicing. And this is because we get attached to the label of jhana. Do we have jhana or do we not have jhana? We get attached to the idea of having a jhana as a thing, rather than looking at what actually is the state of our mind. And this is something that you see all the time, particularly in circles that sort of emphasize a lot on have a sort of spiritual materialistic approach to practice that emphasizes a lot on goal orientation, achieving things, getting particular stages and so on. One of the problems here is that the word jhana is used by different teachers to describe very different states of consciousness and states of meditation. And this is kind of widely recognized and has been subject to a bit of study recently. Apparently there's a book on it that's come out recently. I haven't read it. But generally speaking, there are generally two kinds of states that people call jhanas. And one is using a completely neutral term, is I'll call the banana jhanas. And the banana jhanas are where you have some rapture and some stillness of mind and so on, but the mind can still move, there may be still thoughts, and still sense experience, but bliss and rapture and so on is inside the body, and you feel good, you feel comfortable, the body's relaxed, and so that's first jhana, at least according to many teachers. And then the other term, again adopting a purely neutral and value free term, real jhanas is where you the mind is completely absorbed. There's no thought, there's no feeling of the body, there's no movement of the mind at all. And the mind stays kind of locked in to that state of meditation for a reasonable period of time. And of course the real jhana is being taught by Ajahn Brahm and various other teachers. I won't name here the ones teaching banana jhanas, you can work that out for yourself. Practically speaking, it doesn't actually matter too much, I don't think. For most people it's very difficult to get jhanas, and for most people either can't get them, or if they do get them, it happens, occasionally on a retreat or something like that. And the reality is that only a small percentage of our progress in meditation is actually determined by the meditation technique. And the meditation technique may help to correct some things, to put us in the right direction and so on. But basically it's up to our own efforts, up to our own level of spiritual development and so on, is what really makes it or breaks it. So I don't think it matters too much if somebody's teaching banana jhanas. For most people probably get just as much out of it. The only problem is, of course, when you get attached to that and then you think that that's the real thing and you don't progress any further. And so you this conceit comes in. And so this is why I say that using the word jhana can really disguise that state of meditation, is because when we're talking about it, maybe in a meditation interview, maybe in a discussion with people, or maybe if we're teaching meditation, and we can talk about it and we can use the word jhana as if we all understand what jhana means, but actually we maybe have very different understandings. And also the conceit comes in there, so that, you know, we all know jhanas are really good. So as soon as we start to use that word, then we start to get conceited. I have this very high attainment. So it's almost impossible to sort of get away from that. So when we think that we've got this kind of high level of jhanas, and in fact what we have is what I would call maybe kamika samadhi, momentary concentration. Then it's not a bad thing. It's still a very wholesome and very good state of mind. The practical problem is that if you have kamika samadhi, possibly upachara samadhi, although most of the time when people describe jhanas which are less than what I would call real jhanas, most of the time the descriptions sound to me like what I would call kamika samadhi rather than upachara. The problem is that once we think that that's jhana, we then think, right, we've got to go off and do vipassana. And so we think we turn our mind and we go to investigate and so on. Which again is not a bad thing. Of course it's a good thing to do vipassana. The problem is that if we do that regularly, then we never give our mind the chance to actually deepen and get into real jhanas. And this can become a big hindrance to our practice. In fact, it can stop us forever from actually attaining real jhanas. What we should be really doing when we get kanika samadhi is just keep on deepening our samadhi more and more and more and more. Don't worry about doing vipassana. That'll come in its own good time. So when we talk about these things, we should try to follow the Buddha's example. I think the best way to do it is to follow the Buddha's example and to use ordinary everyday language that empirically describes the actual state of concentration that we're in. I'll come back to that in a minute, but just keep it there for now, which empirically describes that state of concentration rather than using our technical terms. Remember, the Buddha wasn't using technical terms. They became technical terms later because the Buddha had used ordinary language in a very specific way. So it's much better for us. Our understanding of our own common shared language is better. It always will be better than our understanding of Pali words. Our understanding of Pali words, you know, even if we've, I mean, maybe if we've you know, studied and practiced and lived with it for many, many years, we can have a deeper impression of Pali terminology or Indic terminology. But generally speaking, you know, we've known the English words for things for many decades. It's part of what's formed our very understanding of language. It just goes much deeper in using our own natural language than using the Pali, although the Pali admittedly is useful for certain specific things. If we've built up that shared understanding, we know what we're talking about together, then we can use the Pali words. But when we're trying to describe our experience, and we should try to avoid it, try to stick to ordinary everyday language. And just like the Buddha did, we try to be as articulate as possible, as specific and as clear as possible. Because if we're talking to a teacher, or if we're teaching meditation ourselves, then the more clearly we can communicate the experience, then the more clarity is in the other person's mind, the better they will understand that thing that they're trying to understand, and which is hard to understand. It's hard to understand what another person's state of mind is, what another person's state of concentration is. It's not easy. And it's not as if meditation teachers have some kind of magic trick whereby you can just say something and they'll know where you're at, unless they have the psychic power of being able to read minds, which is not very common. So for most of us who don't have any psychic powers, then we have to listen for what the words people say and try to get a sense for what they're meaning and what they're trying to describe. So the more clarity we can bring to that, the more precision we can bring, the better we can articulate ourselves, then the more effective it's going to be, the better that we're going to be able to correct any mistakes and advance to the next stage. One thing I said I'd come back to was this idea of describing a state of consciousness, because this is another problem with talking about meditation. Because states of consciousness are difficult to describe, then it's extremely helpful to understand also the process. And if we look at the way that meditation is taught in the suttas, again, we can see that there's a big emphasis on this, isn't there? In the gradual training, or in the various kind of sequences of teachings and practice dhammas leading up to samadhi, and there's constantly these different sequences, psychological sequences of events that lead up to that state of samadhi. And so we have a context to understand it in, and that makes it much, much easier. And so it's often easier for a teacher, or for a student, this works both ways, or if it's just a friend, somebody that we're talking to about this, it's easier to understand the lesser dhammas, the simpler things, right? So if you say, I was sitting meditation for 2 hours, okay, that's something we can all understand, yeah? So we can easily share an understanding of those basic things. So the more detail and grounded we can get in those basic things, in the whole process of consciousness, of the development of consciousness. What was our mind like before we were sitting to meditate? How did we approach the meditation when we sat down to meditate? What did we actually do? What was the process that we went through? Different stages, different hindrances that arose. How did we develop a particular meditation object? How did the quality of that object change during the meditation? Was there a nimitta or an experience of light? If so, what was that like? What was that experience like? How long did it last for? What was the feeling of bliss? Well, was there a feeling of bliss? Or what did that feel like? Did that feel through the whole body? Did it feel in only part of the body? Was it coming and going? Or was it stable? Was it very exciting? Or was it settling? These kinds of words, ways that we can describe things that actually convey meaningful information. And the more information we can give like that, the more articulate we can be to describe our experience, then the better then somebody can understand where you're coming from, and hopefully perhaps be able to help you to move to the next stage. So this is also very important, is to understand the process. One thing that we often find in meditation, when describing meditation, is we have these meditation methods which are general guidelines for meditation. But very often the key at a particular time is not the method as such, but it's something else, which may be a big thing or a small thing. And so that's also important to try to communicate or articulate. It might be a mood, it might be something somebody said. I'll just give you one example. When I was spent the rains retreat in Pujumkom, I think it was my third rains retreat, and I'd done my knee in, and I couldn't walk properly, and I was walking around on a crutch and staying near the main sala because I couldn't walk up the hill. And I was feeling a bit kind of down about all of this, and my meditation wasn't going as well as it had been beforehand. And then I read a book, or just a talk by Ajahn Lee Dhammadhara. And Ajahn Lee has a very nice way of talking about meditation and breath meditation. And when I read that, you know, he described that so clearly, and it was such a lovely description of meditation, that I felt quite uplifted and quite confident. I thought, I know how to do that. And so I went and I had a very nice meditation. So there you can see these kind of specific things that can influence you, and it's understanding that helps us to understand our meditation as well. So one of the aspects about talking about meditation is like creating a meditative or contemplative community, or participating in a contemplative community, is, as I mentioned before, is this aspect of conceit. Of course, conceit is very normal. It just means that we identify with the meditation itself. Now, there's nothing more intimate to us than our own mind. When we meditate, we come closer and closer to not just to things that we identify with, but to that seat from which identification happens, the very sort of core of the impetus, the motivation, the drive to create a sense of self. So the closer we come to that, the more personal things become, the more kind of, strongly but subtly, we're identified with these things. We're coming close to the home of the idea of self. So it's very important to treat this quite delicately. Not in a rough way. If we are critical or negative about somebody's experience, it can be quite devastating, because it is so personal. So it's quite an act of trust for somebody to talk about these things. It's not an easy thing to do. It's something that's very intimate, and it's not something which should be just kind of bandied around. I remember one time when I was at Bodhnyana, and I'd just come off a 2-week retreat or something like that, and I'd come down for the first time, and we were, you know, getting breakfast, and I'm whatever, pouring myself a bowl of cornflakes or something, and you know, somebody says, "Oh, so did you get jhana on your retreat?" You know. It's not appropriate to talk about these things at that kind of time. Talk about it in at the right time, yeah, in the right situation, and at a time when you're not going to be distracted, at a time when there's a sense of trust, and when there's a sense of meaning about that act of sharing it. Actually, sometimes we can share these experiences because we need some advice or some reassurance or something. Sometimes we have a practical reason, but also we do it just because we want to communicate it. just because it is something that's so personal, so intimate, so important for us, and we feel that we want those who are dear to us and who are around us to understand what we're going through. So this is a very natural drive. There's nothing wrong with that. And so we should be able to do that. It's important so that we understand what each other is going through, both good and bad. But do it at the right time, in the right way. And so when you have that experience, and this of course becomes the other problem when people start using words like saying I've got jhana or something, I've got this or I've got that, is that it then becomes very hard to actually talk about meditation, because if someone says something like that to me, I want to listen to what they're actually experiencing. But for them, they assume that they've communicated their experience by telling me that they've got jhana, whereas in fact what they're doing, and sometimes there's like a subconscious motivation to do this, is what they're doing is actually just hiding what's actually going on. And so sometimes they want to hide what's going on, because this is the way that we conceal our own delusions. So you don't want to disillusion somebody, you don't want to disappoint them by saying no, that's not jhana, because in fact if somebody thinks they've got jhana, if somebody fools themselves that they've got jhanas when they don't, they're still probably doing pretty well. Yeah? I mean, even if you can kid yourself that this is jhana, that's not too bad. Even if it's not real jhana, you're still peaceful and happy and so on. Yeah? So there's nothing kind of wrong with it. But it's just not useful in terms of a way of communicating about it. So it's much better to kind of listen and to try to get a sense for what's actually going on and where that person can go. And it's also important for us to have that awareness of how our own conceit gets involved with these kinds of states. Sometimes people tell me, I'm not conceited about it, I'm not attached to it. And then of course I know that they're completely attached to it. Because of course you're attached. Even an anagami has rupa raga and arupa raga, so it's attachment to form and to formless jhanas. So of course we have them there. That attachment is not a problem, as long as we're just aware of it. Actually, that attachment will just fade away by itself if we don't reinforce it. It's only if we get attached to tell ourselves and get spiritually inflated because of it. It's only if we start to think that we're some kind of great being and so on because of that. But if there's just an ordinary sense of pride in what we've achieved, then there's nothing too drastic about that. We just continue with our practice, recognize it for what it is, and it'll gradually fade away. There's no particular problem there for most people. So we shouldn't think of this kind of conceit that I'm talking about as necessarily a particularly bad thing. It's not. It may become serious in some cases, but for most people it's not, as long as we have the right motivation behind our practice. It's just enough to be aware of it, and then it won't it won't build up too much momentum. And so just to come back to that theme that I started the talk this evening on, is that the very existence of our meditation practice, the very fact that we have a meditation monastery, is fully dependent on the fact that we have words for meditation in our language, that we've heard these ideas and that we wanted to put them into practice. And if we can improve the way that we both understand these words and the way that we articulate them, then that will help us to clarify our own meditation. It will help us also to assist others, to understand where others are at, and to be able to support them and perhaps sometimes correct them, sometimes encourage them in their own practice. And so this is part of what it's like, part of what it means to be participating in a contemplative community. It has that significance which is beyond ourselves. So when we have different states of meditation, when we have good states of meditation, then just notice that tendency to put labels on them. Again, the tendency is natural. Don't worry about the tendency, but just be aware of it and don't get too caught up in it. And like Ajahn Chah would always say, "Mane," and well, maybe not. So if you kind of have a great experience and then you think, "Oh, that must have been a jhana," then just remind yourself, maybe not. Maybe you'll have another experience tomorrow which will just blow that experience away. Maybe tomorrow you'll have something experience which is so profound that today's experience just looks like rubbish. So just remember that, maybe not. And if we have a clear understanding of what the Buddha's teachings are on the meditation and the different states of meditation, the process of meditation, then we'll have a much better framework and guidance for our own progress in meditation. So there's just a few thoughts and reflections for you this evening on how to talk about meditation and what role that plays in developing our practice. So I offer that for your reflection, and I'd like to invite if there's any comments or questions.
I think often there's a fear from of people to talk about their meditation at all, because it's like this background that, especially for monks, that it's you're not allowed to tell anyone if you've got like jhanas or not. This is all this kind of superhuman state business, and that it's kind of like a fear to talk about it at all. And then it's also like if you say you never know if the other person is you telling it, you know, if they've got the same thing or not, and if they're gonna get you wrong, and if they just think you're crazy or something like that. So I think there's a big fear for many people to talk about it at all. And they, if they talk about it, always just generalize a lot, you know, it's like, oh yeah, I had some kind of luck kind of thing, and we also try to stop.
Yeah.
And make it very vague.
Which I think is, you know, is very understandable. It's like you're saying, it's a lot of trust, because it is something that's very, we put a lot of effort into it, you know, and it's very close to us, so it's understandable. Yeah. So it's not really an issue, except that if we're not able to, if you're just happy to meditate and your meditation's going well and you don't talk about it with anyone, it's not really a problem, right, as such. But the problem is, of course, that when something does go wrong, then you don't know how to share that, you don't know how to find a solution. And it also means that if you don't know how to talk about it, it means that you're not sort of contributing to helping others to be able to improve their meditation as well. Yeah. But that's why I said, you know, that basic trust needs to be there to be able to share it with everyone.
It seems to me that in the other type of oral tradition, like in books we usually get, that there's a tendency, maybe particularly in Ajahn Chah, to be very vague about results often. Where do you think that's coming from?
I'm not 100% sure, I don't know how much of that is a result of the translation process, both in terms of the choice of the choice of things and also how it was translated. So it's a bit difficult to say. But one thing about Ajahn Chah's books and his teachings is that almost all of the recorded talks of Ajahn Chah were recorded in the last few years of his life, and almost all of them were general talks or discussions with large numbers of young monks or young people in the community. And so that kind of sense of kind of giving general introduction things, I mean, that a lot of that comes from the context. Apparently, he also gave quite different talks more early on in his career, and a lot of those weren't recorded. So I'm not sure how much we can draw an inference from that. But I do remember one passage where Ajahn Chah's talking, and this was in the book, I think it was in the book A Taste of Freedom, if I remember correctly. And he says, I don't like to use the word jhana because people get too attached to it. I just like to talk about peaceful states of mind. He says, well, anyway, there's the first level of the peaceful states of mind. There's five factors: vitaka, vichara, piti, sukha, ekagata. And but I think that's coming from, you know, the same kind of place that he wanted to avoid people sort of getting stuck on the label of things. And so the forest tradition typically, certainly Ajahn Chah again, would just do that thing of using everyday language to talk about these states as much as possible. Yeah, they avoided the technical terms. And if they did use technical terms, like some of them did, like Ajahn Tate did, then they used them in quite eccentric ways.
Yeah. So I would assume that it's part of this sense of bias that we could see. Mm. I think even in the Beijing monks' biography, it's sort of saying that the monks would get to hear what they're very deep conversations are, and of course we generally can see those.
Right.
Especially as people like this.
Yeah. And a lot of Ajahn Chah's talks are also fragmentary. I think most of them are fragmentary because a lot of them are only 30 minutes long, because in those days they only had C60 cassettes to record the talks. And at various times Ajahn Chah banned recording his talks, so the monks would sneak tape recorders in their bags to record the talk. And it would only go for 30 minutes and then it would go clunk. And Ajahn Chah would kind of blare around, who's got the cassette? No one would be game to turn it over. You see, a lot of them are only 30 minutes long. Yeah.
Excuse me, why didn't people hear before recording
his I don't think he sort of banned it altogether, but I think he, you know, he probably would have said, you know, I don't know. Well, when I went to see an old monk in Northeast Thailand, who was more than 90, and one of the monks said, "How can we record the talk?" And he just said, "Record it in your heart." So I think that they, you know, had that kind of idea that we should be really paying attention in the present moment rather than messing around with bits of machinery. Yeah. And I think also, I think it's very much a part of the forest tradition that the talk is a kind of spontaneous thing with those people at that time. Rather than a kind of an exposition of a set of topics. Yeah. But still, we can be very grateful to the naughty monks who did record.